God was not silent during this period, far from it. The experience of the disaster in Judah and the exile in Babylon and elsewhere may have raised acute questions for Israel's faith in God, but God spoke in particular through three great prophets. The first was Jeremiah. Jeremiah spoke and wrote both before and after the great calamity of 587 BC. He also experienced exile because he was forced into exile in Egypt, very much against his own will. The second was Ezekiel. Ezekiel was, from the start of his prophetic ministry, an exile in Babylonia, as his very first verse tells us. And he spoke and perhaps wrote mainly between the first deportation in 597 BC, which was almost certainly when he was deported to Babylonia, and shortly after the destruction of Jerusalem in 587 BC. And the third is Isaiah 40-66. The book of Isaiah very clearly falls into two parts. Chapters 1-39, written by a prophet often called Isaiah of Jerusalem in the second half of the 8th century BC, and chapters 40-55, which indisputably speak about Israel in Babylonian exile in the 6th century BC. The most natural explanation, it's not the only possible one, I think it's the most natural one, is that this was written by a different prophet who saw himself as a disciple of Isaiah of Jerusalem. He's normally known as 2nd Isaiah and was probably in exile in Babylon towards the end of the period of exile. You notice I mentioned Isaiah 40-55. Chapters 56-66, the end of the book, have no clear historical reference point. My own tentative understanding is that they too were written by 2nd Isaiah, either also during the exile, or possibly in the first years after the return from exile, which we shall think about next week. In this case, 2nd Isaiah may have returned to Judah at the end of the exile. These were the three great prophets whom God raised up. And the fact is that the faith of Israel survived because these prophets had answers to Israel's questions. We're going to look again at those questions, and more particularly the answers the prophets gave in turn. So first, the questions about Yahweh and his justice. And here the prophets gave three principal answers. First and most importantly, the disaster was God's just punishment for Israel's unfaithfulness. This, of course, was no new idea. The writing prophets from the 8th century onwards, from Amos, Hosea, and Isaiah of Jerusalem, had been saying this again and again. And so had their predecessors, prophets like Samuel, Nathan, or Elijah, or indeed Moses, who is called a prophet before them all. In fact, we shouldn't think of the prophets as lone individuals who acknowledge no inspiration except the Spirit of God upon them. On the contrary, they were not only deeply influenced by the foundational traditions in the first six books of the Bible from Genesis to Joshua, but they also consciously stood in the shoes of prophets before them and reiterated their ideas, language, and imagery. But we must also remember that there were any number of prophets who were saying, "Peace, peace," to the people of Israel just before the calamities of the early 6th century, and who were assuring them that God would protect Jerusalem and bring about a glorious escape from the hands of the Babylonians. They were the false prophets. The true prophet's explanation is well set out in, for example, Jeremiah chapter 44, and I'm going to ask you if you would to turn to that. I'm going to read from verse 1. No, from verse 2. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, you yourselves have seen all the disaster that I have brought on Jerusalem and on all the towns of Judah. Look at them. Today they are a desolation without an inhabitant in them because of the wickedness that they committed, provoking me to anger in the way that they went to make offerings and serve other gods that they had not known, neither they nor you nor your ancestors. Yet I persistently sent to you all my servants, the prophets, saying, I beg you not to do this abominable thing that I hate. But they didn't listen or incline their ear to turn from their wickedness and make no offerings to other gods. So my wrath and my anger were poured out and kindled in the towns of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem, and they became a waste and a desolation, as they still are today. And the prophets were not alone in making this point. The great history of the monarchy in Israel and Judah, 1 and 2 Kings, composed or reissued during the exile, as its last words in 2 Kings 25 make clear, constantly says that God punishes unfaithfulness and rewards faithfulness. Here then was a consistent and intelligible explanation of the ghastly suffering that they had been and were going through. What is more, it had not just been thought up because the men of God were having to change their tune in the light of circumstances. It was what many of the prophets had been saying repeatedly for literally hundreds of years. God is not arbitrary or unjust, but he does justly punish those who are unfaithful to him. The second answer that the prophets gave is that God would turn from his anger and forgive. Many of Ezekiel's prophecies are dated. It seems that between the first deportation in 597 and the destruction of Jerusalem in 587, his message to the people of Israel was consistently to point out their sin and God's judgment that would fall on them. But immediately he heard the news of the fall of Jerusalem in 587, he changed his tune. And from then on, from chapter 33 in our book of Ezekiel, God's message through his prophet becomes promised forgiveness and renewal. It is exactly the same in the book of Isaiah. God's first words through 2 Isaiah are the famous proclamation, comfort, O comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that she has served her term, that her penalty is paid. Here is no ducking of the issue. Israel has had to bear the punishment for her unfaithfulness. But despite the fact that she is certainly not even now perfect, God is going to lay aside his anger and bring her comfort, hope, and forgiveness. And this is made possible because of a third answer that the prophets give. The servant of the Lord would take Israel's sin on himself. In Isaiah 40-66, a mysterious figure appears, the servant of the Lord. There are at least 4 passages which refer to him. And I'd like you, please, to turn to Isaiah 53, which is the 4th and the most famous and the most important. This fourth servant passage starts at chapter 52, verse 13, and continues to chapter 53, verse 12. And the heart of it is verses 4 to 6. Surely he, that is the servant of the Lord, has borne our infirmities and carried our diseases. Yet we accounted him stricken, struck down by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the punishment that made us whole, and by his bruises we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have all turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. This passage is, of course, quoted again and again in the New Testament. Jesus himself knew well that it spoke of him. He is the one Isaiah was speaking of. He is the servant of the Lord. Because the righteous judge must and will punish sin, but he will punish it in his servant, who, as New Testament Christians know, is none other than God himself coming to earth in the person of his Son and taking on to himself his own just punishment for sin. And this is the final answer to the question about God's judgment. God is so just that he will not overlook sin, and so compassionate that he will take the punishment himself in the person of his Son and servant, Jesus Christ. And then there are the prophets' answers to the urgent questions about Yahweh and his commitment to Zion. And the first and most constantly reiterated answer is this: Israel will return to Zion. All these prophets envisage a return of the people of God to the promised land. God had promised the land to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and that promise had never been rescinded. True, he had had to punish Israel, and that punishment meant expelling them from the land and scattering them to the four winds. But it would not be long before he gathered them up from all the nations to which they had been exiled and brought them back to the land he'd given them. It is 2 Isaiah who perhaps puts this most forcefully, developing Jeremiah's theme that the return of the Israelites would be a second Exodus, and linking it specifically to the name Zion, in other words, Holy Jerusalem. The ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Here was one answer to the question of Yahweh's commitment to Zion. The expulsion from Zion was only temporary. There would soon be a glorious return. But Zion would not be Zion without the temple. So the second promise in the prophets is that there will be a new temple. This is especially the theme of Ezekiel chapters 40 to 48. Perhaps you would turn to Ezekiel 47. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, of course. Now these chapters, 40 to 48, describe in very considerable detail the vision of a new temple which Ezekiel was given in 573 BC. One of the finest chapters is chapter 47, about the river that flows from the new temple. Chapter 47, verse 1. Then he, that is the angel messenger, brought me back to the entrance of the temple. There, water was flowing from below the threshold of the temple towards the east, for the temple faced east. As the water flows away from the temple, it gets deeper and deeper. Now, I take the story up halfway through verse 6 at the new paragraph. Then he led me back along the bank of the river. As I came back, I saw on the bank of the river a great many trees on the one side and on the other. He said to me, "This water from the temple flows toward the eastern region and goes down into the Arabah. And when it enters the sea of stagnant waters, that is, of course, the Dead Sea, the water will become fresh. Wherever the river goes, every living creature that swarms will live, and there will be very many fish once these waters reach there. It will become fresh, and everything will live where the river goes." And again, verse 12, "On the banks, on both sides of the river, there will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither, nor their fruit fail, but they will bear fresh fruit every month, because the water for them flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for food, and their leaves for healing." This then is the new temple, which Ezekiel describes as at the very center of the land of Israel, and its effect on all life around it. And because it will be at the heart of the new Jerusalem, you will see, if you turn to the very last verse of Ezekiel, what Jerusalem will be called. Chapter 48, verse 35. "The circumference of the city shall be 18,000 cubits, and the name of the city from that time on shall be The Lord is There." So God has not forgotten Zion at all, or his commitment to it. His justice is such that if the Israelites have desecrated the temple by their sins, he will not spare even his own sanctuary, but he is determined to build a new temple and make it a place of holiness and blessing. And third, other nations will worship Yahweh in Zion. You might have thought that the catastrophe of 587 BC would have rather cowed Judah and made her say much less audacious things about her God and his plans. Let me give you this, if you don't mind what I've drunk myself. The reverse was the case. Certainly the disaster made the prophets think harder than ever before about the relationship between the God of Israel and all the nations of the world. But the conclusion they came to was that all the world's nations would come to Judah. Now, sometimes this was expressed as the nations bringing their wealth to Judah and serving the people of Israel. At other times, it was said that the nations would come to worship Yahweh in Zion. I quote, "The foreigners who join themselves to the Lord, to love the name of the Lord and to be his servants, all who keep the Sabbath and hold fast his covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. For my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples." A verse which we've highlighted, if you've read it, in our New Faith and the Future brochure. Because we long that the new church will be a house of prayer for all peoples. And if the temple would be open to all foreigners who genuinely and obediently worshipped Yahweh, this meant that his salvation was to be open to all peoples. "By myself I have sworn, a word that shall not return, to me every knee shall bow and every tongue shall swear." So the prophets tell us, far from abandoning Zion, God has a far more glorious future in store for it, as the place where all nations will find him and worship him. Then again, these prophets had answers to Israel's questions about Yahweh and his covenant with David. Had God reneged on his promise to David and his family? On the contrary, God would give Israel a new and godly king, and a king precisely from David's family. Now, I needn't dwell on this because, again, it's a theme which the 6th century prophets take up from their predecessors. We saw it last time in the writings of Isaiah of Jerusalem, of Micah, and of Jeremiah. Let me remind you of Jeremiah's words. I will cause a righteous branch to spring up for David, and he shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. If any of you could break my covenant with the day and my covenant with the night, so that day and night would not come at their appointed time, only then could my covenant with my servant David be broken, so that he would not have a son to reign on his throne. And it's much the same in Ezekiel. After castigating the self-seeking shepherds or leaders of Judah, God says, I will set over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he shall feed them and be their shepherd. And I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David shall be prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken. Once again, God might have had to punish the house of David for their persistent unfaithfulness. He did have to, but nothing could set aside his promise, his covenant. A line of kings might have to be broken for a time because of their sin, but it would be reestablished. And fourthly, these 6th century prophets had very clear answers to the questions about Yahweh and other gods. It's here that Isaiah 40-66 is so stupendous. Principally, this prophet has 2 answers, of which the first is, the other gods have no real existence. Now perhaps you turn to the end of Isaiah chapter 41. The end of chapter 41. For 2 Isaiah, one of the great realities is the Word of God. The true God speaks, and through his Word acts. The false gods, that is all the other gods of the world, cannot speak and cannot act. You see this in the challenge thrown out to these gods in chapter 41, Verses 23-24. Tell us what is to come hereafter, that we may know that you are gods. Do good or do harm, in other words, do anything, that we may be afraid and terrified. You indeed are nothing, and your work is nothing at all. Whoever chooses you is an abomination. They cannot rise to the challenge precisely because they're imaginary. They have no real existence. Isaiah 40-66 says this again and again. And the high spot comes in the devastating logic of chapter 44, if you would turn to that. Here is a picture of the idol worshipper. I take up Isaiah's polemic at verse 14. Chapter 44, verse 14. He cuts down cedars, or chooses a home tree, or an oak, and lets it grow strong among the trees of the forest. He plants a cedar, and the rain nourishes it. Then it can be used as fuel. Part of it he takes and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread. Then he makes a god and worships it, makes it a carved image, and bows down before it. And verse 18, they do not know, nor do they comprehend. For their eyes are shut so that they cannot see, and their minds as well so that they cannot understand. No one considers, nor is there knowledge or discernment to say, half of it I burnt in the fire, I also baked bread on its coals, I roasted meat and have eaten. Now shall I make the rest of it an abomination? Shall I fall down before a block of wood? He feeds on ashes. A deluded mind has led him astray, and he cannot save himself or say, is not this thing in my right hand a fraud? But to say that the other gods have no real existence is only half of the answer. The other half is that Yahweh is the God of the whole universe. Chapter 40, the opening chapter of 2nd Isaiah, is a magnificent poem on this theme. It asks the question several times, to whom then will you compare me, or who is my equal, says the Holy One? And the answer, of course, is no one. Yahweh is the incomparable God. In chapter 40, Isaiah shows this especially by pointing to God's creating and sustaining work in the universe. And his conclusion is, the Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. But the fact that the God of Israel is the only God, and that his purposes are ultimately good for all the people that he has created, inevitably leads to the conviction that God wants the whole world, not just Israel, to be saved. And this is perhaps most clearly expressed in chapter 45, verse 20. Turn to me and be saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God and there is no other. When you think that this was almost certainly written in Babylonia, surrounded by all the awe-inspiring magnificence of the worship of Babylonian gods, which might have silenced any less inspired Israelite, it is astonishing that Isaiah of Babylon should have been given these insights. Yet it was precisely because he was in Babylonia, in exile, that he came to these conclusions under God. He couldn't there ignore the claims of other gods. He could and did evaluate them, and he could and did see the greatness of the God of Israel as no prophet before him had. And the teaching of these three exilic prophets have an immense amount to teach us. They show that in the 21st century, the century we're about to enter, we Christians need to believe and explain that much human suffering, including the decline of the church, is God's just response to human unfaithfulness. We have lost confidence in the teaching of both Old and New Testaments that God is the judge of all the world and that he rightly punishes unfaithfulness. If we believe it at all, we believe it will happen after death, not in this life. But in jettisoning this cardinal teaching of the Bible, we've thrown away the truth that explains so much human suffering, and we're left without any answers when people very legitimately asked, why has God allowed two world wars? Why does he allow Kosovo? Why does he allow AIDS? Now, of course, the Bible does not teach that all suffering is the immediate result of human sin. Of course, it teaches that suffering can be innocent. Isaiah 53 is the supreme example of that. God's suffering servant. But it also teaches clearly that God judges in this life. He judges nations, societies, as well as individuals. And the Bible would find it very surprising if God did nothing in the face of the massive rejection of him and his laws in 20th century Western Europe. This is a truth not only to recapture and believe ourselves, but to explain to others. Second, we need to believe and explain that only the Father, whom Christ made known, is the true God. I am God and there is no other, says the God of Israel in Isaiah. Right in the midst of Babylon with its alien religion. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me, says Jesus in John's Gospel. Now, this is not to deny that there may be some true insights in other religions. It's not to deny that other religions have sometimes done and still do good in the world. But it is to say unequivocally that all religions cannot lead equally to God, because again and again in the most fundamental areas they are not saying the same things either about God or about human beings. I think as Christians that we should seek to understand other religions so that we don't simply write them out of sheer ignorance, especially if we have friends or family members who belong to these other religions. But we need not only to believe, but gently to find ways of explaining that Christ's claims are exclusive, and that we believe both from our own research and experience that his claims are true. And thirdly, we Christians need to believe and proclaim that God will restore the fortunes of his people, that is the church. The church in this country has surely been under God's judgment for most of the century because of our unfaithfulness. But his covenant with us remains. His righteous anger has been on us for a time. But then he turns to forgive and restore. That, the exilic prophets teach us, is the pattern of his working. Already in the second half of this 20th century, it has been the Bible-believing, Bible-preaching churches that have been growing. And I believe we can be confident that the church in Britain will grow substantially in the 21st century as God turns back in forgiveness and blessing on us, his people. Right, I have time for some questions. Okay, question was, just in case you didn't hear it, how did Jeremiah manage to escape to Egypt when all the other people were taken off to Babylon? Well, the answer really is very simple. The population of Judah was decimated. And it was decimated in four ways, I suppose. Firstly, a lot of people were killed, civilians as well as soldiers, in the various invasions that took place. Secondly, as so often in war, there was disease. Food and water ran out, or it was sullied and so on. And so people died by disease. Third, there were deportations, which in the case of Babylon was specifically to the heartland of Babylonia. But four, as you would expect, people escaped in all sorts of different directions. They escaped to the immediately surrounding countries of Moab and Ammon, for example. And when things got easier, some of them drifted back again. But Egypt, one of the things I've been trying to say again and again and again has been that Israel was throughout the Old Testament sandwiched between two superpowers. Egypt was always one, and the other was somewhere in Mesopotamia, for most of it, either Assyria based here or Babylon here, and actually next week we'll see Persia based more in this sort of area when the Babylonian Empire fell. So it's very natural. Think of the Cold War. If the Russians invade, you go off to America. And so when the Babylonians invaded, you fled into Egypt. It was a very obvious place to go. And this is the beginning of the Jewish dispersion, because once the Jews escaped to various countries, inevitably they began to put their roots down. And when Judah was re-established at the end of the exile, many of them said they didn't want to return. So, for example, in Elephantine, which is down, some of you have been to Egypt, down just past Aswan, so it's off the end of this map here, the Jews actually built, almost certainly during this period, we have documents from a little bit later, but referring back to this period, they built a temple there. And they started worshipping Yahweh, but also worshipping other gods. For example, they said that Yahweh had a wife. So there was a goddess as well as a god. So again, this syncretism, wanting to have it both ways, that we've seen tonight, we've seen again and again in these lectures, was the case in Egypt, among some anyway. So there's a difference between self-imposed exile and Babylonian exile. He did, absolutely, yes. He said, he had said originally when he would, before the destruction of Jerusalem, he'd said, give in to Babylon. Don't go, give in to Babylon. Everybody hated him for it. Then when Babylon had overtaken it and put in a governor, he said, stay here, God will bless you. They said, bad luck, you're coming with us, and took him off to Egypt. Right.
It's refers to him in the past tense there.
Yes.
I don't understand why.
Yeah. It's quite common for the prophets to refer to events in the future in the past. And the reason for this, I think, probably the simplest way of explaining it at least, is that they are so utterly certain that it is going to happen that they express it in the past. Is not an unusual thing for them to do. Yes?
I'll do your first remarks, partly answer, but first I have in mind with the crowd always sent up, why does a so-called good God allow such things as the two world wars and anything else in this rather disastrous century we've been through? And why does God allow it? To ask that sort of question, is that not in the sense getting hold of the wrong end of the stick? Could it not be said that perhaps God neither allows or disallows anything, but man in his sinfulness perpetrates these things, and of course would incur the judgment of God for doing so? Of course, Christ warns us that a nation will rise up against the nation, so this sort of thing is foretold. But surely it is not right to try to blame God for anything that goes wrong. It's man's evil, man's sinfulness that causes it.
I would want to say yes to both the things that you said there. It is, of course, absolutely true that God allows evil to take place. So when we were looking at the history of both northern and southern kingdoms, we saw that certain kings were said to do evil in the sight of the Lord. And God allowed this to happen. He allowed an Ahab and a Jezebel in the northern kingdom. He allowed a Manasseh in the southern kingdom. he allows a Milosevic today, or a Hitler, or a Stalin. That is absolutely true. But I think in this late 20th century, we have been very reluctant to say that God inflicts suffering as a punishment, whereas the Old and New Testaments make that utterly clear that he does. And you said, he allows it, and then you said, for which of course they will be punished. And I would want to affirm that as well. Now, I agree that it isn't necessarily easy for us to differentiate between those. I mean, we're not prophets in the same way that there were prophets given by God at this time. And what is God allowing an evil to happen, and what is him inflicting suffering as a punishment for evil, is hard for us to disentangle. But I think it was actually quite hard, even in the 6th century, to disentangle, because Nebuchadnezzar, who was the great inflictor of suffering on the people of Judah, who caused both the invasion in 597 and in 587 and the destruction of Jerusalem in 587, is described by the prophets as God's servant sent to do his will. So on the one hand, you may think, here he is, an instrument of God's punishing, and indeed he is that. But these same prophets also say that Nebuchadnezzar is himself going to be punished for the destruction that he causes. Now you may say, hold on a minute, this is having it both ways. It's a bit like the problem we sometimes face over Judas. Judas was fulfilling God's will, and yet Jesus seems to have held him responsible for this. How can you be at one and the same time someone who is a servant of God doing his will and then held responsible for doing an evil and punished for it? And I think part of the answer is a straightforward one, and that is that the prophets see Nebuchadnezzar as both being utterly arrogant, not doing this humbly as a servant of Yahweh at all, and also being unnecessarily cruel. Incidentally, something we came across before in the southern kingdom with King Jehu, who was the person who got rid of Jezebel and co, but did it in such an utterly bloodthirsty way that God condemns him for the way he did it. So part of it is fairly straightforward. Nebuchadnezzar, you were doing my will, but you overstepped the mark. But part of it is actually that the interplay of human responsibility and God's purposes is much more subtle than we can easily grab hold of. Someone can be taking moral decisions, which are partly evil ones, and yet be an instrument in God's larger purpose. So what I'm saying is, yes, there are these two elements. God allows evil and cannot be held responsible for the evil in a direct way, for the evil that he allows, but he also inflicts suffering. And actually, the Bible is not afraid to say he inflicts evil, meaning by that suffering. But the two sometimes actually overlap with each other. He allows someone to do evil, and in so doing punishes the unfaithfulness of the people who are affected by that evil person. I'm sure that hasn't tied it up for you, because I think it's an issue that we all struggle with, but perhaps it at least points in a direction. Now, shall I finish on a more light-hearted note and give you these? I've actually been given three now, but I will only give you two. We're talking about the prophets from Hosea to Malachi. Now here's something I didn't know. The first five all have O's in them. That's quite helpful, actually. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, and Jonah. And the second seven, there are 12, have no O's in them at all. So that at least gives you some way in. Okay? Now, you'll never remember this. You need to have some idea where they come, and then it's quite helpful. So this is the mnemonic. Holy Jews announce our judgment. Many nations have zealously hated Zion's mountain. It's very good, actually, because it's got quite a bit of the message of the prophets in there as well. Holy Jews announce our judgment. Many nations have zealously hated Zion's mountain. I think it's rather good. I'll give you another one. I won't give you both the others I was given tonight. Horrible judgments and other jeopardies may never happen. Zerubbabel, we'll come across him next week, hates zealous men. I'm not sure that's quite so true, actually, but anyway, there we go. It's clever. It's clever. What's that? Yeah. Well, you might just learn them one after the other. It might be easier, yeah.